From inside the Kia Studios in Midtown Atlanta, this is Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. And normally I wouldn't say happy Monday, but I'm saying happy Monday for this reason and this reason only. Football is officially here, folks. We trudged through the month of March and April and May and June and July when we had nothing but the end of a Hawks season that was disappointing, a Braves baseball season that's been very, very good, the Five Stripes finally returning to form, but we know what gets you going the most, what gets me going the most mileage of any sports talk radio topic in our industry is football. And as a result, the Falcons, who have reported the training camp on Sunday, will have their first practice in front of you, the adoring public, today in Flowery Branch. We sit just 11 days away from preseason game number one against the Denver Broncos, which, of course, you will have right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, your home of the Falcons, with pregame at 6 and kickoff at 8 from Canton, Ohio. Field conditions permitting, I should say. Although they seem to believe that the field is fine now. But I give you, as we sit here on July the 21st, going into July the 22nd, the five keys for an Atlanta Falcons playoff run, a return to the postseason, a return to the form that needs to happen for the Falcons to get themselves in and be once again a force from the NFC South. Number one seems obvious. Matt Ryan needs to play at the form that he played at during the 16 and 18 seasons, independent of the pounding he took as a result of those stats from his sieve of an offensive line. That's a very loaded number one. But Matt Ryan, with single-digit interceptions, 38 touchdowns in 1 year, 45 in another, MVP-type numbers. You had a run to a National Football Conference championship in 1 year and a 7-9 finish another year. That is at least a baseline of what you need from Matt Ryan in order to at least look like you are going to be a force in this NFC South. The second key, and this is something that Therese Paylor of Yahoo Sports said with me last night on our program here on 92.9 The Game, take at least two of three to begin the season against three teams that could possibly be division winners in their respective divisions. That's Minnesota on the road, Philadelphia at home, Indianapolis on the road. You need to win two of those three games and get to the bye week at least 5-3. If you're 5-3 by the bye, you've got a shot, because they don't play a division team before the bye. And if you think, hey, baseline 3-3 against the division, if you're 5-3 at the bye with 3-3 inside the division, you're 8-6 with your other two games being San Francisco and Jacksonville. 10-6 could get you back in the playoffs. So if you go 5-3 against this first eight of Minnesota, Philadelphia, Indianapolis, Tennessee at home, at Houston, at Arizona, home Rams, home Seattle, I think you get into the playoffs as long as you go 500 in the division. And quite honestly, if you go better than 500 in the division, then maybe you win it. That's obviously, again, a tall ask, but I think a doable ask. I think that you're better than possibly what Houston can bring to the table. I believe you're better than Arizona. I think you can split the Rams and Seattle. And if the only game you lose is one of those three outside of Philadelphia, Rams, and Seattle, you basically have a margin for error for one more game, and it could be possibly that Tennessee contest. But I think you can beat them as well. 5-3 by the bye is what you want to look for if you are Atlanta by the time we sit at the bye week being in week 9. Number 3, as far as the keys to getting Atlanta back to the postseason, will the real Vic Beasley please stand up? The contract year is undefeated in football. Vic Beasley, of course, wanted some long-term commitment made towards him. The lack of a return to form that he had in 2016 made sure that that was not possible. And because of that, he is now playing for his next contract in what is an all-important 2019. He saw his teammate Grady Jarrett, his line mate, and his fellow defensive counterpart Deion Jones both get lengthy contract extensions this offseason. He is going to see the Atlanta Falcons give Julio Jones the kind of deal that could make him a Falcon for life. But he has possibly the most uncertain future of anybody on this Falcons roster. He could go out this year and ball out, command the big deal from the Falcons in the offseason, or have the kind of deal that says, you know what, the Falcons might not trust him, and somebody else will overpay for him, or at least make that bank. But regardless, you have to, if you are Atlanta, reap the benefits of a highly motivated Vic Beasley in 2019 if you're going to have any semblance of success, because an inability to get a pass rush is what's going to lead the teams in this division running over you. You cannot allow Drew Brees free reign. You cannot allow Cam Newton free reign, even with that surgically repaired shoulder. You cannot allow Christian McCaffrey to run rampant all over you. You cannot allow Alvin Kamara to do the same. If the Falcons are going to have any success this year, Vic Beasley is going to have a monster year. Number 4 of your 5 keys for the Falcons to make a playoff run in 2019. Devontae Freeman has to play, if not a full season, as close to a full season as possible. Obviously, because of the fact that he did not play as much last season, people looked at the running back position and said, oh my goodness, what are we doing here? They did make the draft pickup of Olazen, Kenyon Barner, Ito Smith, all those guys are nice supplements to what's already there. But Devontae Freeman needs to be the Devontae Freeman of the Super Bowl year. He needs to be the Devontae Freeman that all you Falcons fans who were screaming at your TV during Super Bowl 51, run the football, run the football, run the football, Kyle Shanahan, I should say. Run the football, Kyle Shanahan, I should say. He needs to be the kind of guy that you were screaming at your TV during Super Bowl 51. Run the football, run the football, run the football, Kyle. He needs to be that guy again for Atlanta. Number one, that keeps Matt Ryan upright. That keeps the defense honest. And more importantly, it gives you a reason to believe that this team could put up the kind of points that they need to compete in what is a high-scoring schedule that you're playing. You're playing teams that can put up points. Each team in this division can put up points. The Rams and Seattle can put up points. So can Houston. So can Indianapolis, Philadelphia, and Minnesota. If you look at the Falcons' schedule top to bottom, you're looking at probably some of the best offensive talent represented in the entire NFL, with the exception of maybe Jacksonville in the penultimate week of the season, and Arizona, who's coming in with a rookie quarterback. But the other 14 games, toe-to-toe, these will be good offenses. Even Tampa, I dare say. So you need as much offensive balance as possible to make things work. And the fifth key, fifth and final key, we need to see the next playmaker on the Falcon defense. Somebody whose name we haven't heard of. Because what was the big thing that made the Falcons a force in 2016? That defense that at the time was a no-name unit. Names that came across and made themselves known for the first time across the National Football League. Names like Keon O'Neill and Ricardo Allen and Deion Jones, Grady Jarrett, Devondre Campbell. These were guys who in 2016 into 17 became household names in the NFL when they were previously either not known or not even in the league. Who is the next great playmaker? Is it Kendall Sheffield? Is it Isaiah Oliver? Is it somebody on the defensive line? John Kaminsky? Is it Sanat? Any one of those guys. They need the emergence of a new superstar defender. And if you get all five of those things to happen, Matt Ryan's season combined with him staying upright, 5-3, by the bye, 2 out of 3 in the first three. The reemergence of Vic Beasley, Devontae Freeman playing, if not a full season, close to a full season, and the emergence of the next defensive playmaker whose name that we haven't heard talked about league-wide, those are the five things I think that you need to have happen if you're the Atlanta Falcons and you want a postseason run. This division, I've said it the entire summer, this division is the toughest division to win in football, in my opinion. Don't give me the NFC West. Don't give me anything in the AFC. This is the toughest division to win in all of football. I think all three of the top teams between New Orleans, Carolina, and the Atlanta Falcons all believe that they can win this division. And I believe, too, that the winner of this division is my favorite to win the Super Bowl. While you think that Carson Wentz could have an MVP season in Philadelphia, I don't know how he acclimates himself to that offense. Because quite honestly, that offense was better when Nick Foles was running it. Amazingly enough. People like the Cowboys. Not really a fan of the Cowboys this year for me. People like Minnesota. Do you trust Kirk Cousins in the postseason? I don't like Aaron Rodgers. And quite honestly, I think very similarly to what we saw with Atlanta, you're going to see a second year after the NFC Championship hangover from the LA Rams, which in my mind leaves the opportunity for some team in the South to emerge as what I believe is the National Football Conference representative in Super Bowl 53. But then, of course, we always wonder what could possibly come about by the time we get to Miami. So many different things that we could have. Super Bowl 54, I should say, in Miami. We are now up to 54, as we should say. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, 92.9thegame.com. When we come back, we'll get back into the college game. David Hale, ESPN.com, will tell us his thoughts on how Georgia Tech handled ACC media days, and also a couple of other first-year coaches in the ACC, how they will handle things, and whether or not Georgia comes into this season with a target on its back. Will Pelagic here with you, Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, 92.9thegame.com. It is Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com as we welcome you back in on a Sunday evening. And let's go to the WadeFord.com hotline and be joined by David Hale, ESPN college football writer. He was basically all around the media days this week. And David, I just want to kind of start with kind of the war of words between Clemson and Alabama. It seems like everyone seems to try to make a big deal about what each of those teams has said about each other. How do you assess kind of the enmity that exists between those two squads right now?
I don't know how much I would call it enmity as much as I think you have a team in Clemson that wants the respect it deserves. I don't know that Clemson is necessarily angry about it, but if I were in their shoes, I would probably be frustrated when The narrative continues to be that somehow they lucked into a 4-touchdown win against Alabama in a national championship game, or lucked into 2 out of the last 3. There's respect that belongs to them, and I think that that saying anything, and look, there are potentially reasons that Alabama played as poorly as they did, but Alabama's best day wasn't beating Clemson. So I think that's sort of the line of demarcation that we're kind of straddling here, is that Alabama's sitting there and talking about, well, you know, this and that, and we weren't quite ready, or our coaches were looking in another place, and all of those things may well be true. And I think that they're certainly worth discussing as an examination of Alabama's failures. But the bottom line is Alabama was not as good as Clemson last year, and you can put any caveat you want on it. Any day of the week, that was the same. I think the outcome would have been the same. Clemson was a better team last year.
It's hard to find a team inside their own conference that's their equal or even close to it, but if you had to pick a team that's next on the horizon, is there one, or is it just, you know, Syracuse in a temporary spot this year, and then next year we'll see?
Yeah, I mean, there's not one, truly. I think you can make a case that certainly anybody can contend on a 1-year or 2-year basis, maybe. And Syracuse was ridiculously close last year. I think looking back, people don't appreciate the fact that it had Syracuse won that game in Death Valley, that by all metrics they probably should have won, they would have been the Atlantic Division champions last year. And so, you know, they weren't far off from pulling off what would have been an historic upset. Those things can happen as college football. But if you want to just say, is there a program that is close to being as good as Clemson, not in a one-game situation, but as a team that, you know, if they played 10 times, could beat Clemson 5 of them, there's no one that's even close to that right now. And I think this year Syracuse could be pretty decent again. I think Miami, if they can find a quarterback, has a lot of NFL-level talent on their roster. I think Virginia is a team that is knocking at the door of being relevant. None of those things are within a shouting distance of where Clemson is, though.
Talking with David Hale, of course, from ESPN, college football writer, looking at some of the things now over the course of the college football media days from the past week. I want to stomp down on Miami, because it seems like with that talent and with the infusion of Manny Diaz, there's a lot of hype around them. How much of that hype do you think will be realized in his first season in Miami?
I really like Manny Diaz. I think he's got a good handle on what needs to happen there. And he did. Look, when they lost that pinstripe bowl game to Wisconsin, I remember I was probably with you at the Cotton Bowl last year, and thinking, my God, this team looks like they're about to fall off the face of the earth. I don't know how Miami puts things back together for 2019. It looked brutal. Manny Diaz came in, brought in a ton of transfers and really talented transfers. It's sort of, in my opinion, the first real college football free agent class, I think, is what they've built at Miami to plug needed gaps. Now, the question still remains, much like it was last year, is there a quarterback on the roster? I'm not sure that there is. Look, people like Tate Martell. I know he has some really good athleticism. I don't know if he's a quarterback. Nikosi Perry, I've talked to some coaches at Miami who thought he did things in spring practice this year that he did not show at any point in his first 2 years at Miami, and think he has made legitimate strides forward. That said, there's no guarantees that he is going to be the guy. They don't have an answer. If they don't have an answer there, then we're still talking about pretty much the same Miami as we saw it last year. A team with a potentially elite defense that can't get out of its own way on offense and will be lucky to get to 7 or 8 wins. They do have decent quarterback play, though. I think, to your point, I think they could be pretty good and certainly be atop the Coastal.
There were a couple of teams that had head coaching switches in the ACC that made very, very shrewd moves, and I want to stop down on a couple of them here. Louisville was a team very similar to Miami that, at least during the regular season, looked like they fell off the face of the earth, especially after that long losing streak to end the season. And, of course, that supplanted Bobby Petrino out. And the fact that Scott Satterfield goes there, I think he takes over a lot more talent than I think people realize. I just think that environment just turned too toxic for Petrino to stay there, and the message got lost. I think Louisville, while I don't know if they're necessarily going to have the kind of season that's representative of what talent looks like, I think they could be better than expected. How do you feel?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. It's almost impossible to judge what they were last year. I don't think that there was a single person in that locker room that wanted to be there by mid-November. I mean, that was an absolute train wreck of a program last year. Bobby Petrino was a miserable person. Everyone around him was miserable. The comments that came out of media days this week were, I thought, rather profound, and that guys had never even so much as been onto the floor of the football offices where the football building where the coaching offices were. There was just such a toxic environment there that I don't know how any team, no matter how talented it was, could have played through that. So I don't know. How do you judge a team that essentially quit last year? I'm with you. I think there is more talent there than they showed last year, and I think Scott Satterfield is doing a really good job of piecing together those players' confidence again. Buy-in is what's critical there, and I don't know that it happens overnight. It may take some time. I still think they'd be pretty lucky to get to a bowl game this year, but you know, I'm with you in that I think if things kind of break right and they can start building up some of that confidence again, that there is an opportunity for them to win a few games, for sure.
Going to the Coastal, I find it interesting here in Atlanta, the excitement for Jeff Collins, and I think that excitement just really kind of exists just because the folks here finally embraced the hard reset of the Paul Johnson option offense and kind of pulled themselves into the 21st century. No offense to Paul, but it seemed like that scheme was keeping them from getting top recruits. How long do you think this will take before Jeff Collins can turn over this roster and turn it into a Coastal competitor?
Well, I really like what Jeff Collins is doing in terms of marketing the program. It's absolutely things that were long overdue. He's selling Georgia Tech as a fun place to be, as the College of Atlanta, as a place that kids can come and play elite high-level football in a cool, historic, fun environment. All of those things are absolutely things that needed to happen. But let's be clear about what he also has to work with. They have offensive players that have never played in this system before, were not recruited to play in this system. You have an offensive line that has effectively never had to step backwards in their lives. You have quarterbacks that were not recruited to play in this. You have probably an abundance of running backs and a dearth of wide receivers. Your only tight ends are the guys that you recruited this year because no other ones have been recruited in a decade. But this is the reality of the offense there. And quite frankly, the defense might be in worse position. It was a very talent-deprived unit last year, one that gave up a lot of points and a lot of yards. And I think, of course, progress can be made, and hopefully I would think should be made this year. But there's also a ton of work that needed to be done. And as you said, whether you want to blame the offensive scheme or you want to blame Paul Johnson in general, or you want to blame the academic standards or the lack of resources that might have been available to them, the recruiting just hasn't been there for Georgia Tech. They've been consistently in that, you know, when they rank them at the end of the year, in that somewhere between 50 and 60 and 65 every year. That's not a top 25 talented class, and some small classes on top of that. So it's a big job is the long and short of it. I think what Jeff Collins is doing is sort of along the lines of what Dino Babers did at Syracuse when he first got there. And let's talk about a bunch of things that aren't about what's happening on the field. Let's get people excited about the program again. And the wins are going to follow in a couple of years, but probably not this year.
Before I get thrown out of town, I do have to ask you about the Bulldogs. I do want to at least acknowledge them, and obviously off of the year that Kirby Smart had a year ago and going into his fourth season, third year with Jake Fromm at the quarterback position. You know, I've been wondering if this window for them is closing because of the fact that Fromm is in what might be his final year with Georgia, because while the recruiting is certainly there to build up a very sustainable roster for years to come, anytime you have a third-year starter and have to turn over that roster at that position, you wonder exactly how much you put all the chips to the front of the table, if you will.
Yeah, I don't know that I would go so far as to say the window's closing, but I think you're right in that they have a unique talent in Jake Fromm. And Fromm is, obviously, like you say, a three-year starter. He's a guy who knows the offense in and out, and a guy that you can essentially say is the cliche of the coach on the field. But he's also a genuinely critical leader to this team. He is a guy who embraces and understands the history and the culture and the magnitude of what's at stake. He grew up a Georgia fan. He is a Georgia boy through and through. I think that there is, if you have the opportunity, as you say, to put all the chips in the middle of the table this year, I think you absolutely have to. This is, they have been knocking on the door two straight years. They were Alabama's backup quarterback away from a national championship 2 years ago and a trip to the playoff last year. I think it becomes a thing where sort of like the curses for the Red Sox and the Cubs or something like that, that if you don't get it done eventually, the magnitude of the losses starts to build to the point that in and of itself becomes another challenge. I think that this is the year that they've kind of got to push past Alabama. And I don't know, it's hard to say. It's hard to predict beating Alabama. Alabama's Alabama for a reason. But Georgia's been right there, and there's sort of this part of me that thinks this is the year. I wish I had a good statistical nugget or some reporting, well-researched anecdote to go behind this. I think it's just a gut feeling. I kind of think they've been rocking the vending machine, and this is the push that sends it over.
David Hale, ESPN, appreciate the time as always, bud, and thank you for not outing me for getting that second helping at the Cotton Bowl press room.
Least I can do.
That's what friends are for. That's really what friends are for. Hope you're enjoying the evening on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game, as it is a Monday morning now, the day that Falcons training camp begins. If you missed it earlier, I had my five keys to a Falcon playoff run. If you missed it, you can find it on the radio.com app archives following the program. Coming up next, I'll talk about two things that usually had some spice, but to me this year were very bland. And I'll explain why next. Whoopalogic here with you. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com. Day we had in Atlanta sports, baby. What a day we had. Braves victorious 7-1 over the Nationals. Atlanta United beats DC United 2-0. Plenty more on that, as I'll bring you the full recap of that about 17 minutes from now. Atlanta Braves a day off tomorrow before starting a two-game set with Kansas City before getting back into divisional play against Philadelphia and once again the Nationals. Should be very interesting to look at that series coming up with Washington and where those two will sit by the time we see them about a week from now. But now, it's time to talk about two things that I thought today were bland that normally give me a little spice. We'll start with the Hall of Fame inductions. This guy going into the Hall of Fame gets no argument from me. Today should have been the day for Mariano Rivera. If there was ever a guy who deserved to go in on his own to the Hall of Fame, it was this guy. Remember the 1 year Ozzie Smith came in and went in on his own? That was pretty cool. But this guy deserved to go in on his own. As somebody who has been to the Hall of Fame during induction weekend, it is no more special. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people were there when Bobby was in, and, you know, the chipper obviously happened as well. If you ever get to a point where if there was somebody who was special to you as a baseball fan that you feel inspired enough to go to Cooperstown for the Hall of Fame, I implore you to do it. But I have to say, unless you're a Yankee fan, you probably went there this year, or a Seattle Mariners fan. I know a lot of Seattle Mariners fans went there a couple of years ago for Griffey. Ask me. I was there. I was there for it. There were a lot of Seattle Mariners fans. And those same people were saying the same thing to me as I'm sure they were saying to people before the vote came in January. You know who really deserves to be in there is Edgar. I don't balk at that one the way everybody else does. But outside of Mo and the first full-time DH to get into the Hall of Fame, I'm not really inspired by a whole lot else in this Hall of Fame class. I felt like people will sit here and say, oh, they got their money's worth with, you know, six different guys going in. No, 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 no. This Hall of Fame class, to me, comes out really blandly. For Messina, a lot of guys who have the fancy stats helped to get him in. Tim Kirkchin helped get Mike Messina into the Hall of Fame. Because Tim Kirkchin sat up there on his high horse, or it's actually a little bit low because, you know, Tim's a very short guy, having stood next to him before. The thing about Mike Messina is that he was one of the greatest pitchers of the 1990s, and he had a tenure with the Orioles that was more memorable than people realize. That's a pretty good thumbs up on the Tim Kirkchin. Good. So Mike Messina gets an assist from Tim Kirkchin in getting him into the Hall of Fame. The fancy stats also. It's funny how things like war and all the stuff involving that makes us think very differently about guys. Like, where was that when we were talking about Fred McGriff going into the Hall of Fame? Where was that for that? Because here's the thing. I look at Fred McGriff's numbers. I look at Frank Thomas's numbers. And then I look at Harold Baines. And I think, okay, Frank Thomas is a Hall of Famer. If you base Frank Thomas's numbers on being a Hall of Famer, you look at Fred McGriff's numbers, same position. He has about 200 less RBIs, more hits, about 30 less home runs. And McGriff did it in the same amount of years as Frank Thomas did. The only thing you can maybe balk at is the batting average is a little bit less. But the OPS was there. He had an 886 OPS. Should get you to the Hall of Fame. Now, of course, Frank Thomas's was 974 because he walked all the time and because his slugging percentage was so high. Crime Dog deserves to be in the Hall of Fame more than Harold Baines deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. No offense to Harold Baines, who, again, I know it's unpopular to take a dump on a guy on his day, but that was the most, when I saw that come out with the Today's Game committee, I looked at who was on that committee, Tony La Russa and Jerry Reinsdorf, two guys who basically were a part of his whole career in Chicago. Oh my. Did that not seem a little rigged to you? It seemed rigged to me then. It seems rigged now. I know it's unpopular to get on a guy when he's going into the Hall of Fame, but Harold Baines is not a Hall of Famer. My criteria for the Hall of Fame is basically this. If I have to think about it for more than 3 to 5 seconds, he should not be a Hall of Famer. Like Lee Smith has the same kind of deal with Harold Baines. He's a compiler. Hung around for a very long time. Do you put Lee Smith in the same category as Trevor Hoffman and Mariano Rivera as a closer? Absolutely not. Do you put them in the same category as Raleigh Fingers? No one says that. And yet here he is in the Hall of Fame, part of that same dopey committee that has put him in. Roy Halladay, I will say this. There are a lot of people who are saying the very insensitive thing right now, saying that his untimely death put him in the Hall of Fame. And I'm not of that opinion. What I will say, though, is that I do believe that the Hall of Fame is reserved for people who have singular moments. If you have singular moments in your career that are defining moments, he had two of them. Threw a perfect game, and he threw the second playoff no-hitter. It happened in the division series. That to me is enough. And you talk about a lot of unmarked potential. There's the Koufax thing in him with Halliday. He could have, if he did not have as many injury issues as he had, could have had a much more long career, a much longer career, I should say, and come out and basically give you the kind of career with the numbers that look like the kind that we used to see from pitchers. But because he didn't have a long enough career, that obviously derailed him. And, of course, the untimely death certainly brought a very amazing moment seeing his wife, which I'm seeing now once again on the television, have a very gripping speech, Brandi Halliday, earlier today in Cooperstown. And Edgar Martinez, of course, basically defined the position. He gets the revolutionary vote for people. So I don't balk at Mo. I don't balk at Edgar Martinez. I don't even balk at Doc. But Messina, Lee Smith, and Harold Baines, come on, man. What are we even doing out here, man? Walt Weiss next in the Hall of Fame? Who's next? I mean, you know, not for nothing. Craig Biggio, kind of the same type of deal. Bit of a compiler. Hot take Will over here. But, you know, it is what it is. Also, while the moment for Shane Lowry was really great, seeing him walk up the 18th, hearing him talk afterwards about how much it meant to him, maybe Lynx golf is just not for me because I found the whole tournament really, really boring. I don't want to watch guys scramble in the swamps, man. I'm sorry. I don't want to see it. I really don't want to see it. But apparently, I got lambasted by my friends in the golf community for not liking the Open Championship enough. Oh, yes, and next year, by the way, this will be the Derek Jeter Hall of Fame next year, by the way. Get ready for a year's worth of that hype for Derek Jeter. Very, very bad. Bobby Abreu also first ballot eligible as well. That should be interesting to see as well. Is Bobby Abreu a Hall of Famer? Is Bobby Abreu a Hall of Famer? If Harold Baines is a Hall of Famer, I guess Bobby Abreu is a Hall of Famer. I have to think about that one. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and 92.9thegame.com. Willie P. back after the mini break after this. You on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. If this was the old school, like, Tony Kornheiser show where we kept the mics on during the breaks, we would do an amazing hockey talk segment between producer Greg Patton and I, since we're both hockey guys in hockey Siberia. We would have thrived when the Thrashers were here, man. We would have thrived. But alas and alack, as they say. This is a feel-good story. The Miami Dolphins are going to pay the defensive tackle, Kendrick Norton, who unfortunately had an accident, a car accident earlier this month on the early hours of July 4th that caused him to have his arm amputated. They placed him on the reserve / non-football injury list, but they will pay his entire salary. So that is at least a good thing for Norton, who confirmed that after the amputation of his arm, he will not have an NFL career beyond this. And he's hoping to get a prosthetic arm as he transitions to life after football. He also has gotten a lot of visits from the Dolphins head coaching staff and also from the general manager, and that all his medical bills will be covered by the NFL and the Dolphins insurance policies. So that at least is a positive step in the right direction for Norton. It is also of note the fact that they mentioned that he was at fault for the accident because of an improper lane change, but there was no foul play or alcohol or drugs as a factor in the accident. It just was a wrong place, wrong time situation, and mistake by Norton in the driving acumen.